I don't know.
Interesting. Okay. And that's Free Solo, and it's also out on DVD. Mm-hmm. And Becky Olson is our guest, and she's the author of numerous books. But right now, the most recent one is Walking Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, as our pitchers said, it's a well-designed book.
It is.
It's pocket-sized, so you can't carry it.
User-friendly.
User-friendly, yes, indeed. So, yes, Mona and I thank you for being here.
Thanks for
talking
about
thing. And up next is Between Covers. Did I get that title right? And it's great to be here with you, Becky. And we
likewise.
I hope you'll be a guest the next time you write a book and climb a mountain.
Yeah, okay. This was fun.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Bridges Cafe and Catering, located at 2716 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Bridges is a restaurant and catering company that's open daily. More information available at bridgescafeandcatering.net. Lunch was provided by Boki Bowl, with two locations at 1028 Southeast Water Avenue and 1200 Northwest 18th at Northrop. Boki Bowl serves ramen with handmade noodles, unique slow simmer dashi, and more. Dinner was provided by Lardo, with two Portland locations at 1212 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard and 1205 Southwest Washington Street, as well as a Las Vegas location at 3708 South Las Vegas Boulevard. Lardo serves deli-style sandwiches as well as craft beers and cocktails every day from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m. or later. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm/give right now.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
This is indeed KBOO Portland, your community radio. It's radio that happens because of, and for the benefit of, and under the auspices of the community. That's you and all your friends and neighbors, and some people you've never met, and probably a few people you don't particularly care for. But one thing you do have in common is your need for and support of community radio. One such entity I'm going to tell you about right now, not just because I'm pleased and honored and privileged to do so, but also because I'm contractually obligated to remind you that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. This is Between the Covers, featuring host David Naiman speaking with Lacey M. Johnson about their latest book, Reckonings.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, professor, curator, activist, and author Lacey M. Johnson, was first on the show for her 2014 book, The Other Side, from Tin House Books, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, Edgar Award, and the CLMP Firecracker Award in Nonfiction. The Other Side was also picked by Library Journal and Kirkus as the best book of the year and deemed by the latter as a modern classic. Lacey M. Johnson is also the author of Trespasses, a memoir, which was anthologized in both The Racial Imaginary, edited by Claudia Rankine, and Literature, the Human Experience. Johnson has a PhD from the University of Houston Creative Writing Program, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Tin House, and Guernica, among others. She teaches creative nonfiction at Rice University with specializations in 20th and 21st century U.S. literature, gender and sexuality, and eco-criticism and environmental humanities. She's also the founding director of the Houston Flood Museum, whose mission is to exhibit the connections between human activities and catastrophic flooding, and to act as a catalyst for reimagining ways to evolve in the context of persistent natural disasters. Lacey M. Johnson returns to the program today to talk about her latest book, her collection of essays from Scribner entitled The Reckonings. The Reckonings was picked as the best book of 2018 by the Boston Globe, Book Riot, and Electric Literature, and was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. NPR says of The Reckonings, equal parts memoir, criticism, and ethics, The Reckonings has bits of Eula Biss, Leslie Jameson, and Simone Weil, but its patron saint is Grace Paley. The 12 essays in The Reckonings are 12 beginnings. Each one deserves great consideration while you read it and long after. Each one leaves the work up to you. Kiese Lehman adds, through prose that is at once passionate and percussive, Lacey Johnson's The Reckonings demands that we place justice and discovery at the center of our conversations, memories, imaginations, and art. I don't know that I've ever been happier to be alive after reading any book. In this weird way that probably says way too much about the smallness of my life, I felt like everything would be okay. Like we will make and sustain justice, because a book I needed but never imagined reading was in the world. The Reckonings is as important as it is masterful on the sentence and conceptual level. The Reckonings is proof that caring about this place and getting lost in the minutiae of what makes us unjust might actually be a prereq for creating incredible, life-altering, just art. Welcome back to Between the Covers, Lacey M. Johnson.
I'm so glad to be back. Thank you so much for having me.
So your new book, the essay collection, The Reckonings, comes from questions that arose after your book before it, the memoir, The Other Side, was out in the world and being responded to. So orient us to the questions that people were asking you or the desires that they were expressing about your own life after your memoir came out that sort of began this questioning. Because I even remember when you were here last, you were talking about working on these questions of justice.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was, when I would read and talk about The Other Side, audiences, usually who had not read the book yet, who had just heard me talking about it, one of the questions they asked when they found out that he had gotten away, that he was a fugitive living in Venezuela, he would say, or they would say, you know, what do you want to have happen to him? And they would follow it with, you probably want him dead, right? And I found that question so troubling and interesting because I don't want him dead at all. I don't necessarily want him to be my neighbor, but I didn't want him dead. I didn't want him to suffer. And that question to me just revealed so much about how we in this culture kind of think of justice, which is, you know, you do something bad happens to you, and therefore justice. But to me, that doesn't seem like justice. You know, if we think of it as an eye for an eye, and there has to be symmetry, making him suffer doesn't do anything to help me. It won't make me feel any better. It won't erase the last 19 years of trauma and nightmares and, you know, the way that altered, you know, how I move through the world and how I relate to other people. So can we call that justice, or can we think about that justice? And if that is not justice, then what is? And so that, you know, I was thinking about that while I was, you know, I began thinking about that while I was, you know, on tour with The Other Side. And I stopped at one university, Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. And a person in the audience there, this wonderful writer named Leslie Jill Patterson, she had brought me to campus and heard me give this answer to the question, which was, I don't want him to suffer. I don't want him to die. What I want is for him to admit what he did to my face in public, and then to spend the rest of his life in service of other people's joy. And when she heard me give that answer, it reminded her of this other book that she had read by an author they had brought named David Dow, who has a book called Autobiography of an Execution. And it's a wonderful book. And he's a lawyer, works on the death penalty in Texas. And she put a copy of this book in my hands and said, you should read this. And I did. And then it got me thinking about how, you know, these questions that I was asking are, of course, questions that we ask around the death penalty and larger questions of justice. And that book led me to Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy, which was so powerful and rearranged my brain in all the best ways. And then I wrote an essay about the death penalty called On Mercy, which didn't scratch the itch. And I realized that there was something bigger and larger underneath it, which was these more broader and cultural questions about justice. And then I was sort of on my way to writing a book.
Hmm. And you mentioned in this answer, this desire for symmetry and an eye for an eye. And you do go back to the Code of Hammurabi.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about how maybe we look at that code, which we think of as this desire for symmetry differently than how it was actually enacted in real time?
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, we think of it as an Old Testament proclamation, right? An eye for an eye, because it is there. But it's also, it dates, you know, it's older than the Old Testament. It dates back to the Code of Hammurabi, which is, you know, 5,000-year-old. It's, you know, the first set of written laws. And we refer to that as if it is a mandate, as if we say, you must, you know, if someone plucks out your eye, you must pluck out their eye, that is what justice is. But in fact, what was meant by the law was that it should be a kind of upper limit on retribution, like no more than plucking out your eye. Because what was happening was, you know, someone would steal a neighbor's cow, for instance, and that neighbor would respond by murdering their entire family. And so the Code of Hammurabi was meant to just sort of put an upper limit on vengeance and say, no more than that. But that's not to say that it was a mandate. And that to me just says so much about, you know, retributive hatred, that when someone harms us, often our response is hatred, and hatred, it's very easy for it to sort of metastasize out of control.
As you sort of alluded to at the beginning, you've mentioned that a lot of readers have responded with a difficulty of letting go of this idea of punishment.
Yeah.
And they seem to equate your statement that either someone's going to get punished or they're not going to have any sort of reckoning. Mm-hmm. So they're going to go free. And of course, it's unsatisfying for the sense of that there's nothing that's going to happen to the person who did some injustice in the world. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about what might be between those two extremes. You mentioned, for instance, about your fugitive ex-boyfriend who kidnapped and raped you and then fled to Venezuela, that you wouldn't want him to suffer, but you'd want him to have a reckoning. Mm-hmm. That sounds more like a spiritual reckoning, that, or if not a spiritual reckoning, a emotional reckoning that would prompt him to dedicate himself to repair around what, in some fashion. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think of, I couldn't find the article, but there was this interesting article in the New York Times that was asking this question of what do we do with people in the Me Too movement who aren't the people who should be in jail? Like, so if we put aside Harvey Weinstein and people who are like full on doing criminal behavior, and even put aside the celebrities like Louis C.K. or Sherman Alexie, who've leveraged their power and harmed other people's careers, as well as been sexual harassers. And we just look at the common day sexual harassment or predation or violations of norms within college campuses, and how this article is talking about, like, how institutions pass the trash is what she called it. Mm-hmm. So instead of there being any reckoning or any consequence, really, it's they're protecting their student body, but they're also sort of protecting their liability. They don't want to go to court. They don't want to spend the money, and the person's record doesn't get affected. They get to go on to another school.
Mm-hmm.
So it perpetuates something while also doing a small good, but perpetuating the larger bad, perhaps. But it was interesting about that article. She's like, no one has asked the question what it would look like for those bad actors who aren't criminals. What would it look like for them to come back in a meaningful way? Like, what would that look like? She didn't have any answers, but I love that she asked it. And I don't have an answer. And I'm not expecting you necessarily to either, but I was that weird space, I guess, of, well, what would it take for your fugitive ex-boyfriend to come to the place of dedicating his life to something in response that owned his own responsibility?
Right. So I have a lot of kind of jumbled thoughts about this. I don't know that, you know, I intentionally did not in this book say, you know, to write a how-to, like, it looks like X, Y, and Z. You know, my vision of justice looks like this. But I think on the one hand, one argument that I do want to make is that perhaps we are focusing too much on what happens to the men. That in many ways, what happens to the men is not necessarily how we should think about justice, because even in everything that you said, we didn't talk at all about the women that they've harmed or what we need to do to amplify their joy in this world, or to sort of return them to a place where the condition of joy is a possibility again. And I'm much more interested in thinking about that and in focusing my ideas and my efforts on how we make the condition of joy a possibility again for the women and men and children who have survived these men, and less on thinking about these men who do this harm. So that's one answer. The other answer, I think, I felt really moved and compelled by the Larry Nassar trial, and that's a criminal trial, so it's again different from the question that you're asking. But I had never seen anything quite like that before during the victim impact statements section of that trial, where a few of the women that he had molested and abused and assaulted were given the opportunity to speak to him to his face and tell him that what he had done was wrong, the way it had harmed them and affected them in their lives, the way it had altered their past, the way that they had imagined their trajectories and their careers and what success looked like, and how he had altered that and he had no right to do that, and that, you know, that they were furious and full of rage, and they got to say that to him. And he didn't get to object. He didn't get to insert his own narrative over that. He had to listen. And meanwhile, the judge affirmed each woman who came to speak and said, "Your story is valuable. You are so brave. You are an amazing woman. You're so strong. You are going to go out of here and your life will be wonderful." You know, and that, you know, I'm tearing up just sort of thinking about, you know, having the opportunity to do that, where an institution like a court is accepting a woman's story of her own experience as truth. I mean, it seems so obvious, but it's really, really not. And that then, you know, the first few women spoke, and the judge, and her name is escaping me right now, I apologize. But she, you know, she said publicly, like, I'm going to leave this open until the beginning of the week, because I imagine that there are some women out there who would like to come speak and haven't come spoken, and they're a little bit afraid to, but I want to tell you, like, this is your time. I'm going to leave it open for you. And then, you know, on Monday, more women came and more women came, you know, and Larry Nassar was sitting on the stand, and he wrote a statement going, like, this is causing me pain. Mm. You know, I want to escape this. And, and the judge took the statement and tore it up and threw it on the ground and said, you have to listen to what these women have to say. And I'm going to, you know, sort of center their voices and their experience in this moment. And that to me was the thing that I just, you know, it was an example of the thing that I describe. Or that I call, you know, a reckoning, that I want to be able to tell this person who harmed me the ways that he harmed me. And I want that to be sort of acknowledged and validated in a public way. I do want him to admit it, to say, yes, I harmed you in these ways, and to not gaslight me, to not, you know, sort of try to twist my words and my experience so that I doubt myself. And then what happens to him after that, I honestly don't really care. I wish that he would go and, as I say, spend his life in service to other people's joy. But after that, I think our paths can fork, and he goes his way and I go mine, and what happens to him is not really my concern.
We're going to take a moment and invite some KBOO volunteers into the studio to talk about how you can get a copy of Lacey M. Johnson's book, The Reckonings, and how you can support volunteer-powered, non-commercial, bioregional community radio here in Portland, Oregon.
Hello, my name is Tave Fache Drake, and I'm here with my friend Ken Jones, and we are here for the Spring Fund Drive at KBOO Portland. We know that hearing people's stories is important to you. We know that speaking the truth is important to you, and we know that you want to make a difference and to keep that a platform here in Portland at KBOO. So please give us a call at 877-500-5266. That number again is 877-500-5266, or go online to kboo.fm and hit the donate button. For a one-time $60 donation or a monthly $5 donation, we would love to say thank you to you with the gift of this book by Lacey M. Johnson, The Reckonings. We also have an option of a tote bag, which is wonderful for books.
Caring books.
Books or LPs, or a beanie, because it's still cold this time of year.
Oh, yeah. So you can get all those gifts. You pick one of those. So Lacey Johnson's book, The Reckonings, the beanie or the book bag for a minimum pledge of $60 a year, which is $5 a month. You can do that through credit card, debit card, electronic fund transfer from your bank, whatever's easiest for you. We have volunteers here at the phones, and they can walk you through the process. The number to call, 877-500-5266. I want to talk a little bit, Tavi, about the literary community in Portland. And KBOO has very strong connections to the literary community and helps give voice to a lot of the writers who might not be on a national level yet, but are starting out and will soon be, you're better known. And also a lot of the writers like Lacey Johnson, who comes into Portland. We've done over the years many, many great writers, big, big names coming into Portland thanks to Powell's. They do their readings here, and a lot of them end up on KBOO. And that's what a lot of your membership money goes to support. 80% of our operating budget, again, comes from your membership fees. Between the Covers as a show goes back, I think, 30, 40 years. Jim Schumach might have been the original host there, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, David's kind of maintained that and taken it to a whole new level with his incisive analytical questioning, and the authors that he talks to just seem to relax around him and reveal things that they wouldn't normally reveal, much to their chagrin when they listen back and see what David has extracted from them. So again, programming like that, you're supporting with your membership at 877-500-5266.
That $5 a month, it expands exponentially. So, you know, you make your one-time $60 donation or your $5 a month donation, and really that's expanding by tenfold, by a hundredfold, when you figure that it's bringing to you programming on local authors, authors from around the world who are coming in here, and they're doing interviews in person for Between the Covers. That's also something very special about that.
They almost all
show.
Come into the KBOO studio. I know there's several authors that I've interviewed, even picking them up at the airport, or they're staying at a hotel downtown because they're in town to read at Powell's. And we take them over here. We're about 5-10 minutes away from Powell's downtown and from a lot of those downtown hotels, and then take them back. And we've got that recording for the ages of writers on each book that they I wish I had a list of name here, but I know some of the people I've interviewed were William Volman, Cory Doctorow, latest one with Liz Scott. She's got a memoir coming out called This Never Happened that will run on Mondays Between the Covers. And David's spoken to a lot of literary luminaries, both local, national, and even international. And so it's just an amazing program, Between the Covers. You'll find that on KBOO, or you can listen to archive versions. If there's an author I've mentioned you want to look back on the website, kboo.fm, you could search for that name, and chances are there'll be an interview with that person, and you can download it, stream it. All that because of members like you and the money that you give us at these membership drives, spring, fall, winter, and we might have a special one in between there. We don't come to you all that often each year, but we really need the support, the financial support.
And we know you care about that. You want to be part of this community in an active way. You want to be part of it in a listening way as well. But by putting your dollars there, you're making the difference for yourself and for the whole rest of the community. Call us at 877-500-5266 with your donation today. And we have some options for you as a gift. We could give you The Reckonings by Lacey M. Johnson. We're gifting that to you as our way of saying thanks. Lacey M. Johnson's book you're hearing about now. David's been interviewing her. The book The Reckonings, or a tote bag. It's called Music Makes the Movement tote bag, and it has a logo on here with a sort of vintage looking microphone and the KBOO station name up above it, or a black beanie with the KBOO radio tower on it. And those are all our ways of saying thank you to you for supporting local radio and supporting community radio, because essentially by pledging us $5 a month, you are contributing, and you're getting a book group through Between the Covers, as well as other programming. You're getting a film club.
Film at 11. We heard that a little earlier.
You're hearing about veterans. You're hearing about sports, even on certain programs. You're hearing music. So you're getting essentially what you would get from any other music subscription. You're getting all of that rolled into one here at KBOO Portland. Call us right now at 877-500-5266. Make your dollar count. You're going to make it count in your lives, the lives of everyone around you, and you're a smart shopper in a sense as well. And we have these gifts to say thank you to you. So go to kboo.fm, click donate, or call 877-500-5266.
You know, it's a fascinating book, Tave, Lacey M. Johnson's book, The Reckonings. She previously wrote a book called The Other Side, and that was a memoir of a time she was kidnapped and raped. And people kept asking her, what would you like to see happen to your rapist? And this book, The Reckonings, is her reply, in fact. So let's get back to Lacey Johnson and David. Meanwhile, give us a call at 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
We are back with the author, Lacey M. Johnson, talking about her essay collection from Scribner called The Reckonings.
Well, I'd love to pivot to talk about the way The Reckonings deals with the question of whiteness. Because in a certain way, you do this move when you're talking about how, when we're talking about what happened to you, for instance, you want to focus on yourself and on your own self-autonomy and versus what's going to happen to the perpetrator of the act. And I feel like this move happens over and over again in the reckonings. Mm-hmm. It feels like an ethics, essentially. And similarly, you take other things that could be approached in a passive and a sort of external way, and you activate them and make them something internal.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the way that, despite the way white people generally act, you insist that race is not something over there. It's something right here, and mm-hmm. it implicates us all. So I would love to start this discussion about whiteness, if you would talk about the incident that happened in school when you were a writing student that sort of became the kernel of the essay against whiteness, and then maybe we can take it from there.
Sure. So when I was still in graduate school, I was in a poetry workshop with several other women, and our faculty member was a woman of color who I admired and continue to admire a lot. And she was maybe one of, let's say, three women of color in the room. And one week we had a conversation. Someone in the class had said, "Has anyone read this other faculty member's new book?" And the other faculty member was a white man. And we had not, none of us had read the new book. We weren't studying with him. We were studying with this other person. And the person who brought this up said, "You know, because, you know, I'm wondering because these poems seem racist." And so we had not read them. And I think the next week, I don't remember exactly the timeline, but I think the next week we came back and we had copies of the poems. And we all agreed they were, yes, definitely racist. And there were really complicated, bad, ugly things going on in these poems. And so the week after that, the white poet was invited to, and the white poet was very senior, was invited to come to the classroom where I guess we were going to just have a conversation and try to figure out sort of what was going on. And the conversation began. He sort of sauntered in and was like, "Hey, ladies, I hear you have some questions about my book," you know, which is maybe not the right note to start on already. But, you know, because it's so full of so much like bravura and, you know, bravado and just like, you know, toxic masculinity and things like that. And so someone said, "Well, yes, like we have some questions about these poems and sort of how race is working in these poems. It seems troubling to us." And he instantly began shouting, was so defensive, was yelling at the student, was yelling at the faculty member, was yelling at all of us. He told one of my peers to shut up when she was talking, and he told this woman that I admired, the faculty member, his junior colleague, that the poem that, you know, when she expressed some concern over these poems, he said, "These poems are not written for you. These poems are written for white people." And it's chilling. Like I just feel like it makes me so ill to think about now. And maybe one of the things that makes me just as ill is that I didn't say anything while all that was going on. And I have deep shame and regret about that. I felt like my jaw was on the table. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, that this was happening, you know, and also, you know, that the fact that there was a faculty member behaving in this way. I also felt like I have not ever known what to say to a man who's exploding under the pressure of his own narcissism. But at that time, I didn't say anything. I knew what I was seeing was wrong, and I didn't say anything. And eventually, he stormed out of the room. And one of the other classmates, who was one of the other women of color, she turned to me and she said, like, where were you just now? Like, why didn't you show up here? And I didn't have an answer. And I knew that staying silent was wrong. And it was wrong, and I did it anyway. And so I guess the essay tries to begin unpacking that, like why I felt like the ways that silence was not only wrong right at that moment, but in many ways is what whiteness has meant to me all along in my life. And in many ways, what whiteness requires all white people do is that we witness wrong, terrible things happening to people of color and comply with them, accept them, look away, and just remain silent. That our privilege and identity in many ways relies on our being complicit with the oppression of people of color.
Mm. Well, you don't mention in the essay or now who your teacher is and who the guest poet is, but because both poets have written and spoken about it publicly, and other poets have written and spoken about it publicly, and because Claudia Rankin and I talked about the incident with Toni Hoagland on the show when she was here, I kind of wanted to use their exchange as a jumping off point about whiteness and also the idea of what reckoning could look like.
Yeah.
So for context, at an AWP conference, Claudia Rankin read the poem many of your classmates thought was racist by Toni Hoagland, and then read both a letter she addressed to him and a response that he prepared for her to read. And Claudia Rankin's address begins with a paragraph that goes, "I don't like using the word racist because if you use it, it means you're an angry black person. Angry black people are the old black, and everyone knows that's pathological. The new black is accomplished, assimilated, and integrated. The new black reaches across the aisle. The old black is positioned in a no-win situation where to express an opinion based on what you see, experience, feel, or deduce risks falling right into some white folk's notion of black insanity." And later in this letter, she speaks to how things in your class derailed between him and her and says, "Needless to say, before our conversation started, it was over. I can still see myself back then confused at the rate of escalation, given that I was so used to everyone reassuring everyone that everyone accepted everyone and race didn't matter. Who let America in the room? How did things get out of hand so quickly? I sometimes wonder if one of us had had the presence of mind to say, 'Easy, slave girl. Slow down, Grand Wizard,' could anyone have laughed?" And I love that last line so much that, but for that last line to occur, it seems to me that both parties would have to acknowledge that they live in a world where they are complicit in certain constructions of race that they themselves didn't invent or create, but which to various degrees they're perpetuating. Mm. So you write about this, about whiteness as a construct, and you've even gone so far as to call whiteness terrorism.
Yeah.
And I would love for you to unpack this way of looking at whiteness for us a little bit.
So as I was saying just a moment ago, I think whiteness very much depends on violence. Violence is how whiteness and the boundaries of whiteness is policed. Whiteness demands the oppression of people of color. Whiteness did not exist as a construct until, you know, the 17th century, when it was invented to justify kidnapping other humans and selling them as slaves. And ever since, it has been a sort of tool for creating social hierarchy, for perpetuating the lie that we have what we deserve and we deserve what we have, that everyone is in their proper place, and that this is due to some kind of biological reality. And I think that Yeah, I think that that is terrorism, to suggest that humans should be placed into a biological hierarchy. You know, I'm thinking about this now for a different project. There's this, and I'm going to sort of, and I know that I'm kind of going around the question slightly, but there's this guy named Ernst Haeckel. He's a German, he's maybe contemporaries with Darwin. And I came to his work because I'm very interested in these diagrams and drawings that he made. He's very well known for his drawings of Radiolaria, these sort of microscopic sea creatures. And they're beautiful. They're beautiful, spectacular drawings. And I came to them and realized that that there was no biography of him in English. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll write one because, you know, he's a philosopher. He's a biologist, you know. He's, you know, a physician. He was many things and just seemed like a kind of fascinating person. But as I began scratching at the surface, I discovered, you know, he was a best-selling author, essentially, in his day. His works were extremely popular. And the what he wrote about, his most popular works were on eugenics, and that he was a eugenicist. And that his ideas about nature... sort of, we have inherited them to this day. He placed humans not in separate races, but in separate species, right? And we don't, and that there was a clear hierarchy with white men at the very top and all other species sort of on the tree going down, right? That they were more inferior, closer to nature, closer to, you know, less evolved. And we don't still hold the idea that humans are different species, but we still talk about race as if it's a biological reality, as if it's something real, instead of something that's, you know, policed and constructed. The idea of white women in particular, and maybe that's one of the things that I'm thinking about in that essay, is sort of my role and culpability and responsibility and accountability as a white woman in this world, or something that's intelligible and recognizable as a white woman in this world, to the particular history that has been, you know, particular history of violence that's been perpetuated on the bodies of people of color, in protection or preservation of my body as a product, as a sort of vessel through which to perpetuate white supremacy. And so I'm thinking about how I... like what my, where my responsibility and allegiances should lie in that. And I think the conclusion that I come to is that we have a moral responsibility, white people do in particular, to dismantle white supremacy, to destroy whiteness as much as possible, to be very bad white people, and to sort of reject and acknowledge the ways in which privileges constantly being offered to us, and that we, you know, as the inventors and beneficiaries of white supremacy, it is our, it should not be the burden of people of color to do that work, that we should also be engaged in that work. And in many ways, you know, we made that mess and we should help to clean it up.
Mm. We're going to take a moment and invite some KBOO volunteers into the studio to talk about how you can get a copy of Lacey M. Johnson's book, The Reckonings, and how you can support volunteer-powered, non-commercial, bioregional community radio here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Tave Fache Drake, and I'm here with my friend Ken Jones, and we are here as part of the Spring Fund Drive. If you care about hearing the truth, if you care about hearing women's stories, if you care about hearing true stories from those of us from all genders, please call us at 877-500-5266 and make your donation today. You can also go online to kboo.fm and click donate. Any amount makes a difference. From a dollar upwards makes a difference. But for a $5 sustaining membership or a one-time $60 yearly donation, we do have a thank you gift for you, and it is Lacey M. Johnson's book, The Reckonings, that very I'm going to get emotional. I'm so sorry. That very powerful book, Speaking Her Truth, and addressing so many topics that are a problem in our society, and really challenging us to step forth and make a difference. And I know you want to make that difference. So please call us at 877-500-5266 with your $5 a month donation. We'd love to give you this book as a thank you gift. We have another couple of options as well. Tell them, Ken.
Oh, for that same minimum pledge of $60 a year or a recurring membership, a sustaining membership of $5 a month, there's also the KBOO music book bag. You could put music in there, of course. Okay. LPs fit very well, they books, CDs, and maybe a few donuts on the side there in case you get hungry. And we also have the KBOO black beanie, which is the coolest beanie in town. It shows your pride in KBOO, that you're a KBOO member, and that's also for a minimum pledge of $60 a year, $5 a month. The number to call is 877-500-5266. Our volunteers can walk you through the process, whatever's easiest for you. That $5 a month on a credit card, debit card, EFT from your checking account, or if you're doing well these days and you want to increase that from $5 a month, say that you pledged last year for $5 a month, now you want to raise that to 10, we'd be very happy to take your call. Again, the number 877-500-5266. And Tavi and I were talking about Lacey M. Johnson's book, The Reckonings. I was saying that here was a response to something tragic, terrible that happened to her, a kidnapping and a rape. People were asking her, what would you like to see happen to your rapist? If it were me, I think I'd have a whole book full of tortures and revenge and stuff. But she actually took the higher road there and wrote a meditation on not just revenge but and rape, but also the concept of evil. She was just talking about decentering and dismantling whiteness and white privilege. She talks about feminist art, truth and fairness, oil spills, government malfeasance, police killings. It's just an incredible book, and I think you get a very strong idea in David's interview with Lacey.
Definitely. What Lacey's done is she's taken one horrific experience and she has turned it into a way to create change for so many injustices that have been going on for so long that have not been spoken about enough on public radio, in the news, etc. And what you are doing by making your call to us at 877-500-5266 is you are creating a platform where those true stories and that information on how to make change and that the idea that we can do this and we can do this together and there are options for us out there and that we are not victims, that we can all support one another in a very loving, proactive way. That's what you are doing by calling us at 877-500-5266 or going online to kboo.fm. Make your one-time $60 a month donation, your one-time yearly $60 donation or your $5 a month donation or increase by $5 a month. We would love to say thank you with The Reckonings by Lacey M. Johnson. And you can hear these firsthand accounts by her, this amazing work that she's done. And you will keep this sort of programming on the air, from music to books to movies to voices from veterans to cooking shows to sports talk to all sorts of powerful and seemingly trivial ways, however, that you can either make a difference or be part of something bigger than yourself. And I know you want that. I crave that myself. So do pick up the phone and call us at 877-500-5266.
And Lacey's interview, or David's interview with Lacey M. Johnson, is just part of the Between the Covers archive, which is just incredible. If you missed any part of Lacey's interview, or you want to hear previous interviews on Between the Covers, you can do that thanks to the KBOO website. All this audio is archived online. Just go to kboo.fm. You can search for Between the Covers. You can search for individual authors such as Lacey M. Johnson. And we bring you at least one of these author interviews every week on Between the Covers. Sometimes there's so many authors that are coming in. There was the AWP, Tavi, about 2-3 weeks ago, where writers were coming in from all over the country. It's a big what does it stand for? Something like something writing, American Writing Program, something like that. Anyway, it's a huge conference. They had 12,000 people descend on Portland, and we got a lot of interviews in there. Many of those writers came down, certainly not 12,000, but a few of those 12,000 came down to Portland, recorded interviews, and you've already heard them on KBOO, or you will in the near future. And really, it's not just the reputation of the city as a literary community, thanks to Powell, but really at this point, KBOO has a reputation within the literary community where authors are very happy to come on and discuss the books much more in depth than you'll see, say, on a morning show or even some podcasts and radio shows. And that's what KBOO brings you. It comes at a cost. We do have expenses somewhere a little under $900,000 a year, between $800,000 and $900,000 a year. 80% of that operating expense comes from you. So it's really time on the second to last day of the spring drive to call us, 877-500-5266.
Yes, keep the lights on. And we'd like to say thank you to Michelle from Southwest Portland for renewing, and also Timothy from Lake Oswego for renewing, and Cherie in Southeast PDX for renewing. Thank you to all of you, Michelle, Timothy, and Cherie, for renewing your memberships. You are doing your part, and we thank you profusely from the bottom of my heart. I thank you. And if you have not been a member in the past, this is a wonderful time. As Ken's saying, we're on our second to last day here. We've got some money that we really need to have come in so we can keep our towers up and repaired, so that we can keep the electricity going in here, so that we can keep bringing you these very important interviews like you're hearing today that David Nimo's doing with Lacey M. Johnson. So call us with a $60 a year donation or something greater or less, whatever you can afford to come out of your pocketbook. Keep the lights on, keep that voice of free radio and community radio going by calling us at 877-500-5266. Go online to kboo.fm. You can also contribute through Instagram or Twitter. We have a number of different ways that you can make that. And one thing I will tell you is, this is a safe space here. KBOO is a place where all of us from all backgrounds come together to volunteer, to do work, to bring you programming, to learn, and to be part of something else. And it doesn't matter your background, your socioeconomic status, your gender, your race, where, what walk of life you're coming from. You are here and you are welcomed at KBOO, and it's a safe space to be who you are and to speak your truth. And I know that matters to you, and you are making that possible by calling us here at 877-500-5266. You are keeping that safe space for everybody, and by calling in, you're going to get a real person to talk to and make that donation. So 877-500-5266. Back to you.
We are back with the author, Lacey M. Johnson, talking about her essay collection from Scribner called The Reckonings.
Well, I think a good place to end is a topic that you bookend The Reckonings with, which is joy. The last essay is entitled Make Way for Joy. And if we return to the beginning of the book, the epigraph by Juna Barnes is, "The unendurable is the beginning of the curve of joy." Mm. So in grappling with misogyny and sexual violence, white supremacy, colonial violence, and the rapidly closing window of opportunity to salvage an inhabitable planet, talk to us about where joy fits in.
So for me, and it doesn't necessarily apply to all of those forms of injustice, but what I'm writing about in that particular essay is just the way that, you know, if the historical view of justice, the one that we've inherited, requires suffering, and that we perpetuate suffering on another person. In many ways, that definition of justice is another injustice and requires that we continue perpetuating injustice on one another. You know, you cause suffering, you must suffer, and on and on and on. You know, that and I think that what I have come to at the end of that essay, or what I hope to capture, is, you know, if we're invested in, even in, let's say we're invested in symmetry, this symmetrical equation of, like, you know, eye for an eye, you know, it's a symmetry of suffering. But I think I've realized there's another kind of symmetry that we can ask for, which is if you cause suffering, if you take joy out of the world, that perhaps justice means putting it back in, right? Rather than taking more away. And that for myself, as I think about justice in my own situation, with, you know, having been kidnapped and raped and very nearly murdered by this man I used to live with, justice really doesn't have anything to do with what happens to him. It has to do with me and the way I move through the world. That essay is about running. I'm a runner. I'm a very slow runner. But I like doing it. And it's, you know, I run, a lot of times I run with my dog, or I used to run with him. He's getting a little old now, but at the time of the essay, he was still running with me. And I feel like I need to run with him because I run in the very early morning when it's dark. And I have not yet reached a place in my life, or the world has not yet reached a place in its life where I can't run without feeling afraid. I can't run in the dark without feeling afraid. And so the dog comes with me because he's very large and he's very protective. But each time I do this, I go through a process of feeling afraid. You know, I hear a noise or something. I feel afraid. I feel afraid of being out there all alone. You know, I still continue to sort of suffer the harm and the consequences of that thing that happened 19 years ago at this point. But then, you know, I sort of manage to talk myself off the ledge of my own fear. And I do that by acknowledging my body and what it's experiencing. And then I move through a place of feeling like I'm moving through the world. My legs are carrying me very slowly, but they are. You know, I go up hills and down hills and over bridges, and then every morning I get to see the sunrise, and it's beautiful. And it, you know, I get a runner's high, and I feel good. And the feeling that courses through my body is joy. And I don't feel small and afraid and vulnerable. I feel alive and free and strong. And running teaches me to be present in my body. It helps me not just when I'm running, but it also helps me like in the rest of my life. It's helped me to be more present with my children, you know, to be in the moment with them. I think one of the most enduring effects of having been kidnapped and raped all those years ago was that I have a really hard time existing in the present moment. I'm always sort of thinking about another time or the past or the future or catastrophizing forward or you know, sort of experiencing a flash of a memory of the past. And running has helped me train myself to be just right here in this moment. You know, the moment I write about in the essays, like, I'm on the floor of my kitchen and they're laughing, and I can be right there with them laughing, and that is joyful, and running makes a tiny space for joy to enter my life, and I do find justice in that. And thinking about then, like, what, I guess sort of extrapolating outward to the other situations that I write about, the other injustices that I write about in these essays, is maybe the question that we should return to them with is like, what do we need to do in this situation to make the condition of joy a possibility for the people who have suffered this harm? What would it take for, you know, the moms who live near the burning nuclear landfill to be able to feel joyful and not worried about, you know, the health and safety of their children who are, you know, the hair is falling out of their bodies and they're chronic nosebleeds and they're being poisoned by the environment? What would it make to make the condition of joy a possibility for the people who are living near the ship channel? What would it take to make the condition of joy a possibility for people who whiteness as oppressed, you know, people of color who are fighting every day for their right to live and survive. What would it take for us to be able to make the condition of joy a possibility? And also just on an individual level. And I don't know that I have answers to those questions because I don't think joy can be prescriptive. I don't think what it takes, but I think that's a question that I want people to take away and to ask is sort of what, you know, what does joy look like for me?
Well, I think one of the miracles of the reckonings is it sort of goes back to the way Casey Lehman described feeling hopeful because of reading this book. I mean, given all of the topics that we covered and that we come out the other side with a sense of a possible different future, it's really remarkable, and I'm so glad you came back on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoy this conversation. I always enjoy talking to you.
We were talking today to Lacey M. Johnson about her essay collection, The Reckonings. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And I'm Laurie Sonnenfeld. This is Moving On. We come to you every Friday with folk music from noon to 1:30. So stay tuned. There's going to be some great live music today.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Bridges Cafe and Catering, located at 2716 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Bridges is a restaurant and catering company that's open daily. More information available at bridgescafeandcatering.net. Lunch was provided by Boki Bowl, with two locations at 1028 Southeast Water Avenue and 1200 Northwest 18th at Northrop. Boki Bowl serves ramen with handmade noodles, unique slow simmer dashi, and more. Dinner was provided by Lardo, with two Portland locations at 1212 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard and 1205 Southwest Washington Street, as well as a Las Vegas location at 3708 South Las Vegas Boulevard. Lardo serves deli-style sandwiches as well as craft beers and cocktails every day from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m. or later. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm/give right now.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of